We are now only seeing 18% of our temperatures below 70 degrees at night, which is very alarming for us. Normally, we see 35% of the temperatures below 70 degrees. And while our high temperatures are going up, our low temperatures are going up faster than our high temperatures. So we're losing that diurnal and nocturnal cycle very quickly and all that implies. The average temperature in San Juan in the last 60 years, this is shocking, has gone up 8 degrees Fahrenheit. We think of, in large part, due to the heat island effect, but that is affecting our rainforest, which is not so far. We're only 100 miles by 36 miles. So it is affecting our rainforest and our surface temperature because we have so much cement. We're at 140 degrees Fahrenheit, measured by NASA, which prompted some baseball players that practiced in Arizona to mention that it was hotter in Puerto Rico than it is in Arizona when they were practicing. Our average days of precipitation are going up. We have extreme weather events frequently. We just had a 33-inch rain event. That has not been unusual. Covering it on TV has been very strange to have to talk about 12, 24 and a half. Colleague here from Fish and Wildlife in Puerto Rico, she knows it's been, we've got gallons of rain falling from the sky. Cases of dengue have gone up. And just to give you an idea, only 7% of our lands in Puerto Rico are protected. We have 52% semi-permeable of our total landfall. 11% is not permeable, it's covered with cement only, so we only have 37% that is not impacted by development. Garbage is an issue. We have everything. We're multi-faceted. We have every problem that you can think of. And we've lost 90% of our coral reefs in eastern Puerto Rico. Doves are mating twice a year. Trees are flowering twice a year. Our globe is. I don't know what the translation is. But if anybody doubts global warming is happening, have them come to the Caribbean. And with that, I want to introduce you to Dr. Gregor Hodgson. He's the Executive Director of Reef Check Foundation.
Good morning, everybody, and thanks for coming. I figured everybody would be at the beach at the end of the conference here, so I'm amazed that people are actually still coming to sessions. That's wonderful. I'm the executive director and the founder of Reef Check Foundation. We're an international organization, nonprofit, devoted to saving reefs worldwide. We operate in 90 countries, and we're in about, I think, 25 countries in the Caribbean, including particularly the country I'm going to talk about, two countries I'm going to talk about today, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. We work primarily, our core program is through citizen science, by getting people into the water and trying to change hearts and minds, and then trying to get them to become active in actual conservation activities. And it's unusual when we go to a country like Haiti where people are absolutely scared to death of the water and they don't know how to swim. And so we started with a group of 70 students at the three major universities, whittled that down eventually to a smaller group. And I'd like to show you a short video that came out in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, which really tells the story of what we've been doing with our student eco-diver program in Haiti. There are three goals to our program in Haiti, which is funded by the MacArthur Foundation, among others. And the first is setting up eco-diver teams who can monitor the reefs, because there has been no scientific work on the coral reefs of Haiti previously. It's pretty amazing also to go into a country where there's almost nothing known about the reefs. And so one of the goals is to survey the entire country. We've done about 300 kilometers of coastline so far. The biggest fish we've seen has been about that big. It's really, really bad, really overfished. And the third goal is to set up a national network of marine protected areas. So once we've analyzed the data, going in and determining which areas would be most appropriate to set up marine protected areas. So I'm going to show this video now, and then after that's finished, I'd like to show just one slide from the Dominican Republic.
In Haiti, the problem is we do not like our environment as we should. We should know what the environment means to us.
Growing up in Haiti's crowded capital, Jessica Lalois longed to be closer to nature and the sea. Now, a year and a half after her home was destroyed in the earthquake, she has an opportunity. volunteered to be bused an hour north from Port-au-Prince to train to become eco-divers, scuba divers who will be responsible for surveying these endangered coral reefs.
Okay, put your hazardous goggles down. Okay, I want you to swim to the boat, and then come back.
But there was one hitch. Jessica, like most Haitians, had never swum in the ocean before. Until a few months ago, she hadn't been able to tread water.
Diving, swimming, is a way to show you that you are in the environment and it is yours. If you are part of it, and you don't have to destroy it, this is what it means.
J'ai déjà fait quelques exercices à la piscine, mais ça c'est ma première emmerde. Donc, un petit peu excitée, j'ai un petit peu peur, mais je pense que c'est bien.
And now, I can say that I can show you.
The lessons were organized by Reef Chat, a California-based nonprofit that monitors reef health around the globe. During a three-day workshop, Reef Chat's director, Gregor Hudson, taught students about reef ecology and the effects of overfishing. Taking them out onto a nearby reef for what he called immersion education.
For me, maybe the most rewarding thing is watching when they can go down and dive down by themselves for the first time, and they come up and they're so excited because they survived going underwater, and they saw a bunch of fish, and they're swimming with the fish.
When they asked me to dive, I was a little bit scared because it seems like my mom was talking to me and saying I don't want to go under the water. But after all, I was more curious than scared, and I got it.
C'est une première expérience et c'est normal que je me sens un petit peu wow. J'ai parlé de la demande, je suis très content.
We'll be training the students we've selected out of 70 original applicants from all the top universities here in Haiti. Eventually, they will form the very first Reef Chat eco-diver team in the country of Haiti.
Hodgson came to Haiti after the devastating earthquake to survey reefs like this one near Labanab Island, looking for quake damage. Instead, he found something more alarming: vast stretches of dead coral and almost no fish.
Haiti is the only country in the entire Caribbean that doesn't have a marine protected area. So we're doing all the survey work and setting up these monitoring teams in anticipation then of doing the analyses of the different reef areas and then recommending to government where would be the very best places to set up marine protected areas.
Currently, the fish here are so few and so small that fishermen are using small gauge nets to catch them. Decades ago, fishermen here used to spear and net large predator fish, but as those have dwindled in number or disappeared to deeper waters, fishermen are left to scour the reefs for small fish like these. Herbivores that keep the coral clean of algae. Now those two are almost gone, and the algae are taking over.
If we could set up a network of reprotection areas, then that would allow these fish to reproduce, to get bigger, to become mature, and then there would be a lot more fish around for people to eat.
For the students, the sad state of the reefs here hardly dampened their enthusiasm for the sea. The simple act of going underwater has meant the discovery of a whole new world.
It's like I was in a movie, in paradise.
I'm going to say, so I met the gentleman that wants to keep who I agree. I'm going to put it down. You're going to have it to be honest.
distraction from the hardships endured since the earthquake.
Hannah discovered another word, an other worry, amazing. The fish pond is very an attractive place. Down there, I discovered everything. The sadness, everything. It's like I was living, living a new life.
So one of the students from the class is here today, Alexander Pierre. So if you want to give a round, really know what's going on in Haiti, you should check with her later. So just to finish up, the end result where we'd like to get to is like what we have set up after 5 years of work in the Dominican Republic, the same island, the other end of the island. We have we co-manage a marine protected area there called La Coleta. It's right next to the airport at Santo Domingo. If you could go there, please do. It's been closed down to fishing for 1 year. The fishermen are the strongest advocates for the closure because they've seen the amazing results. We now have large grouper coming in, and the fishermen shown here on the right with Dr. Sylvia Earle are making money from a snorkel business, a kayak business, and a scuba diving business there. And that's the ultimate result of what we want to do. We want to get the people in the water and partner with all the local organizations and set up marine protected areas and use other tools to create a well-managed system. Thank you very much.
You'll be interested to know that 80% of Puerto Ricans do not swim either. My personal opinion is that that passage with the Niña, la Virgen de la Santa María, and those slave ships must have been horrible. And it's now ingrained in their genetics. Also, 70% of the Puerto Rican fish, the coral reef fish, are overfished as well. And with that then, let's talk to Dr. David Guggenheim. He is the director for the Cuba Marine Research and Conservation Program. He's known as the Ocean Doctor.
And setting up, I'm going to tell a Susan Soltero anecdote. first of all, as one on the other side of the microphone, it's always a pleasure to have somebody as enlightened as, sorry, close your ears. As enlightened as Susan, and she has interviewed me in Fort Lauderdale and in Puerto Rico, and we were on, I guess it was Anita's Young, on TV, and the camera is about to roll, and this is all being done in Spanish, and I say, por favor, es posible para usted hablar un poquito más despacio. Please speak a little bit more slowly, just because I want to make sure I understand you. And she looks at me, and she goes, David, this is TV. So I was barely hanging on. Just speak fast.
It's a cultural thing.
Just said, I want to spend a few minutes and talk about Cuba. And for those of you who were at the earlier panel, I want to recommend Dan Whittle, one of my fellow panelists from the Environmental Defense Fund, who was on that. I'll talk a little bit about what happened during that panel. But I want to focus on Cuba's coral reefs. I've been working in Cuba. I'm a senior fellow at the Ocean Foundation in Washington. I've been working in Cuba for 11 years now. And it's been incredibly gratifying work, but you can tell from the color of my hair that it's also been maddening work along the way. Cuba still has some of the most magnificent intact ecosystems in the Caribbean, and for many reasons, of course, one of the most obvious being that they did not follow the leader in the way the rest of the Caribbean decided to develop over the last 50 years. They did something very different, and it's had good, bad, and ugly results. Socially, it hasn't worked so well, but environmentally, along with very good environmental laws and practices, it's had some great benefits. At the previous panel, I spoke about human scientists, our colleagues. This is the Centro de Investigaciones Marinas, the Center for Marine Research, part of the University of Havana. This is the only institution in Cuba where you can become a marine biologist. hotel. It's in a rundown building. One telephone line for the entire building. So you're on the third floor and a phone call comes in, the secretary will walk over the stairwell and scream your name. I'm impressed at how hard these people work with in such poor conditions. Just basic scientific gear is absent, and even a boat. Now, if you're going to be a marine biologist, getting on water and in the water is critically important. This is the research vessel at the University of Havana. It is literally made out of rock. It is ferrocement. It was infested with cockroaches. There was no generator until recently. One of the best things we could bring down with us were roach motels. And this is where all of the at-sea science had been done before our partnership launched the project almost 10 years ago now. Another reminder, and this is a sobering reminder, this is a colleague, Alonso Ramos, who was supposed to accompany us on an expedition this summer. We brought an American vessel into Cuban waters. We trained him. He was going to participate, and I got word that he died tragically when a scuba tank he was filling exploded. This is what the Institute's scuba tanks looked like. The one that exploded was built in manufactured in 1985, had not been properly inspected. And just an awful, awful tragedy. Before we left, we were able to leave all of our tanks with them, so at least they've got some good tanks to go. I'm still dealing with paperwork with the Commerce Department for acting first and asking for permission later. But for almost a decade now, we've been involved in Proyecto Costa Nova Occidental, a project focusing on Cuba's northwestern coast. Never really been comprehensively studied before, and as a result of this partnership, many of those students that you see on the boat have relied on this partnership to get their master's and doctorate degrees, and one of them in particular is now actually vice director of the center, and many of them are in positions of leadership growing up into their careers, thinking of Americans as friends, not as enemies, and as close colleagues, maybe a bit nutty, but and the result of this research is giving the first maps of the Gulf of Mexico region. Many, many papers have been published. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the Gulf last year, I'm just going to touch on this because you can't really talk about Cuba and the environment right now without talking about oil. The platform that Cuba is going to use for oil's development is on its way. We just heard in the last panel it's rounding the Cape of Good Hope in Africa and in South Africa, and it will be here in just by the beginning of December, and they will be drilling shortly thereafter in a well that is deeper than the deep water horizon, the Macondo well. But ironically, when the oil spill happened last summer, the currents were set up in such a way, this is the loop current that comes into the Gulf and comes back down, and the way it was configured was that models projected that all of that oil would end up along Cuba's northwestern coast, the very area we were studying, and you may remember these modeling studies that were on TV every night showing the projection of that oil going up the east coast of the U.S., even some into Mexico. Fortunately, that did not happen because of a change later in the currents, but we heard from our Cuban colleagues. We held a meeting in Washington with the State Department, Coast Guard, and so on to try to coordinate a response, and learned very quickly that we were not ready at all. Some great people in the administration wanted to help, but we are limited by layers and layers of paperwork and licenses. And the work that Dan Little is doing and that I'm doing and others are doing, trying to encourage the administration, this is a neighborhood issue. We have to work together. We have to have a direct dialogue with our neighbors. Even if neighbors don't get along, they have to protect the neighborhood, and we have to have an emergency response plan. We have to have equipment and licenses in place to import that equipment or export that equipment if necessary. This was recognized by the President's Commission on the Oil Spill. There are specific references to Cuba in this, and calling for a tri-national Cuba, Mexico, and the United States collaboration on establishing standards in the Gulf of Mexico for drilling and for emergency response. And that's the co-chairs, former Florida governor and senator, U.S. Senator Bob Graham on the left, and former EPA administrator under Bush number one, Bill Riley, on the right. This is setting up as we speak, and that is the reality. What I can say, it's kind of bad news, but it's a DeLorean, you're not imagining things. After this morning's Shark Talk, I was getting pretty depressed, and many of us, there's some coral reef lines, we get depressed thinking about the state of coral reefs, and privately, some of us conservationists who know we have to have a cheerful public face are having, crying into our ears at night when we know just what the reality is. And we wish that we had a DeLorean or some sort of time machine to go back and see what it was like before we really affected these ecosystems more than half a century ago. And I learned that a time machine is actually not a DeLorean, it's a 52 Buick. Work in Cuba. Cuba really is a time machine in so many ways, and a living time machine. And honestly, this has given me more hope than I've ever had in my career because the ecosystems are so healthy. We have just recently, in the last 2 years, started working in Jardines de la Reina, the Gardens of the Queen, named by Christopher Columbus to honor Queen Isabel. I don't think Columbus was a scuba diver, but if he were underwater, he would see this. This is a garden. That's what I think of when I think about Jardines de la Reina, a beautiful garden I took this photo this summer. And I want to show you just a couple quick video clips and talk about the health of these corals and why it's so important that we're finding these corals so healthy there. One of the most tragic events that's unfolded over the last several decades is the loss of Acrophora palmata, or elkhorn coral. It's one of the fundamental rebuilding corals that many species are dependent on. NOAA estimates it's 95% gone from the Caribbean now. Let me show you a quick clip here. This is filmed this summer. It's just a quick clip. I, in my whole life, have never seen Acrophora palmata look that healthy. And it goes on for miles. And everybody is home. All of the components of the ecosystem, the fish, the invertebrates. It's just remarkable to see that those corals there. What you do see now are some of these smaller Acrophora palmata corals starting to come back in some areas like the Virgin Islands, in the Dominican Republic, and places like that, small areas, but nothing like this. I skipped over that guy. That was an Nassau grouper, which I hadn't seen in decades, and was very exciting to see. It's like seeing an old friend. It was my Jurassic Park moment. But here are, just saw some pillar corals, a pretty rare coral, which has also been a casualty. But you also see a great deal of these soft corals and fish. And the important thing to know about Jardines de la Reina is it's one of the, one of the largest protected areas in the Caribbean. The entire area is about 1,000 square miles, but it's a no-take area with the exception of certain areas open to lobster in its core in much of that area. And as a result, you have large predators alive and well, like this magnificent black grouper that was allowing me to follow. And this baby Goliath grouper, this is about a 200-pounder, critically endangered species, as are the Nassau grouper. And these black grouper have some friends. These are Caribbean reef sharks, which were everywhere. And never been in the water with so many top predators at once. And what's important, and I brought this up this morning at the shark panel, is that we are really changing our way of looking at the role of predators in the ecosystem. First of all, scientists are continually surprised when they stumble upon an ecosystem like this, as they have in the Caribbean and the Pacific, that the ecosystem can support so many top predators, so many sharks. But we now understand better how those dynamics work, and these guys have important jobs at maintaining the community structure of fish, including those very important fish that graze the reefs and keep them clean. The other thing that these guys have done is protected the land. This is a big rodent called a pupia. It utilizes the mangroves, beautiful bird populations, but it's a reminder that to protect coral reefs, you have to protect the life support system, which includes mangroves and these all-important roots, these nursery areas, as well, where a lot of good things happen in those root systems, all those grouper that we love to spawn in those areas. So the obvious question is, why are the coral reefs so healthy in Cuba? And I think I already alluded to that. Part of it is that they didn't develop the in some of these areas are far offshore. Cuba was forced to practice organic farming after the Soviets pulled out, and therefore much less in the way of nutrient pollution. And yet they are still in the same warming and acidifying waters that the rest of us and the rest of the world's reefs are in. So the theory, the working hypothesis, is that if you do right by your coral reefs and take care of the local stresses, including overfishing, one of the most important ones, this area again is restricted, no fishing, that these systems will be more resilient to the impacts of global threats such as warming, not infinitely resilient, but more resilient. All of this is speculation right now, and the object of our research is exactly that, to find out and quantify, using this as this living laboratory that, you know, biologists dream of, to go back and have the before data, before before human impact. So I hope to keep you apprised of our progress along the way, but just I thought you might appreciate a little bright spot in an otherwise what can be a very depressing issue.
And more good news, we have a large area of the same kind of corals in the north course of Puerto Rico and in Bayana, in that area. And I just found out yesterday from our Secretary of Natural Resources, who was going to be with us today, that they are going to protect that area. They are relatively healthy, and we're trying to kill them. I mean, they're trying to develop that. You know, they throw sediments and contamination on them, and they've stayed alive. We've had wave events, and they've stayed alive. But finally yesterday, he said, we're going to protect them. So we've got more good news. And that leads us right into the interconnectedness of our countries. You can't do right by Cuba and not do right by Haiti. So Nadine Patrice is the executive director of Operation Green Leaves, and she works in Haiti, but she's also worked in the Dominican Republic.
Okay, but on that incorrect, I know part of the Dominican Republic. She'll be talking about the Dominican Republic, but we're interconnected because we are sharing the same island. And there's hope, because Haiti's coral reefs are in dire need, but hearing both speeches from Dominican Republic and Cuba, there's hope that if we can learn from you guys, and hopefully things can change. So, I don't work in Dominican Republic yet.
Oh, that was Angela's song. She told me to ask her about it. Anyway, talk a little about Operation Green Leaves.
Well, I'm here to talk not only about Operation Green Leaves, but also about Haiti, which is my passion. I'm the executive director of Operation Green Leaves. And we've been around for more than 20 years already. And the mission of the organization is environmental education, ecological restoration, and of course, the reforestation of Haiti. more than 21 years old. I'm just one of the founding founders of the organization, and the youngest one. 21 years old, I think they really, really fast. And my whole entire life changed 21 years ago when I visited Haiti after I left when I was about 8.5 years old. Because in the life of a child, you know, everything is beautiful. Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. So I visited Haiti 21 years ago. And in my mind, Haiti was just beautiful. But when I got there, the abject poverty that I saw and witnessed at that time changed my life forever. Although I live here in South Florida, there's no way I could turn a blind eye and not do something. So I wanted to get involved and do something. However, it was not until I saw a video by Captain Jack Cousteau, which the video was called Haiti, Water of Sorrows. I don't know if any of you have seen that video. It was on the coast of Haiti. It was Haiti, Waters of Sorrows. It was about 1996. So any of you, if you want to see that video. It was then that I understood that everything in the environment is interconnected. So then we understood, if we wanted to do something about Haiti, that we had to address the environmental issues there. And in the video, he warned us that if nothing was done in Haiti, the way the rapid rate of deforestation and degradation in Haiti, by the turn of the century, Haiti would be a wasteland. And right now in Haiti, there are definitely signs of desertification. So both of you have been to Haiti and you know what I'm talking about. In the 5 minutes that I have right now, I'm going to try to just paint pictures of Joey, what Haiti is right now, and I have, you know, more information later, because in 5 minutes is very difficult. But I specifically, while I'm speaking, I have this slide for you to show you the demarcation between Dominican Republic and Haiti. As early as 1924, 60% of Haiti was forested. Today, there's less than 1.5%. So this shows you the rapid rate of this deterioration and the urgency of something that has to be done. Haiti possesses 6 ecological regions: the rainforest, the dry forest, the pine forest, the mangrove, and wetlands, which are the 5 base ecoregions. The marine ecoregion contains animal, plant, species, as well as coral reefs. Some of you don't even know that Haiti has a rainforest. Any of you knew that? No. Haiti has a rainforest called Big Manaya. And I know you talked a little bit about protection. Haiti has 35 areas of Haiti are protected. The issue is not protection, the issue is enforcement. So Big Manaya, which is a rainforest in the south of Haiti, is one of the places that are being protected. The environmental crisis in Haiti is complicated by poverty. This has had a profound negative impact on the environment and the lives of the population. The vulnerability of disasters in Haiti will continue to grow unless the issue of basic subsistence is met and tackled and resolved. Over the last decade, there has been a considerable reduction of forest cover. Like I said, 60% of Haiti was forested in 1924, and now only 1.5%. The limited forestry area of the country is a direct consequence of the high demand on domestic energy in the form of firewood and charcoal. Around 72% of domestic energy needs come from biomass, particularly, like I said, firewood and charcoal. And the charcoal, you know, some people say, why are they cutting the trees in Haiti? It's not a question that they don't love the trees, it's a question of survival, like the video, Mr. Gusto's video said. It's like, either I cut the trees to make charcoal to have money to feed my children, or they go hungry. So we have to address the alternative. If you tell them not to cut the trees, you have to definitely address the issue of giving alternative economy, sustainable alternative for the economy, and as well as energy. So it's not that they keep the trees. Water is another issue in Haiti, as after the earthquake, a lot of you have seen. Water is unavailable for a considerable amount of people of the population in Haiti. During the last decade of the 20th century, less than 60% of the population had access to drinking water. It should also be noted that the problem is not the scarcity of water, it's the inaccessibility of water. It's not that there's no water, it's, you know, accessibility. And then when they are dry, sometimes also just, you know, reduces the population's water supply. So water in Haiti is a very, very big problem. just to share a story with you, after the earthquake, I had one of the CBS reporters call me, and he said, you know, I was just shocked. I know going to the earthquake was shocking, but he takes pictures. And he said he watched an old man in Haiti after the earthquake was bending down in the water and taking the water to wash his face and drinking it. He stopped and said, what are you doing? And he said, I have no other choice. And he called me, he wanted to discuss that with me, and he wanted to document this kind of situation maybe through, you know, through pictures. So water is a very big issue. And we go back to what they were talking about, the coastal marine heritage in Haiti. Haiti's coastal marine heritage, they have exceptional wealth without the problem that of the human problem with overfishing and trash, as he showed you in this video. I mean, it's just incredible. These are human problems that people put because they don't have the other alternative. And lack of enforcement. Just like there are 35 places of protected in Haiti, but only 3 of them are enforced, which is Pic Macaya and the pine forest. I bet you some of you didn't know there was a pine forest in Haiti. No? See? There's a pine forest and there's a rainforest in Haiti. And of course, the third one that's protected is Palais Sanssouci. So the issue is to not only protect these areas, but also enforce, and most importantly, is provide education and awareness, which is one of the things that our organization does. We don't just plant trees, we educate and provide alternatives, which is so important to have long-term resources. So the environmental challenges that Haiti must now overcome are tremendous. I mean, the central problem with respect to the environment and conservation affects the quality of life, and it relates directly with the energy sources. So now, the use of firewood and charcoal versus the preservation of the few remaining forests and water resources. They have to choose, unless you do the whole circle and give them the alternative. So I invite you to learn more. I am here. I had invited some of the people from Haiti to be here. They couldn't be here. So I have a whole document if you have questions. They couldn't be here. But there's a lot of other people working in Haiti doing what is necessary. So we need the light shine on Haiti so people can understand what is going on so we can really help Haiti advance with the environment, restoring this environment. Because Haiti is only 800 miles from the shores of South Florida. It is right there. But a lot of people are not really aware. They know they have an environmental problem, but they're not really aware of what is going on in Haiti. So I invite you to learn more. We have a website. Learn more, get involved. And I do hope some of the journalists here will take the opportunity to visit Haiti. I know there is going to be a post tour to Cuba, and I wanted to have one in Haiti, but it didn't happen this time. But I'm here to talk to you. Hopefully I inspire you to go to Haiti, learn more, and we can learn from the other islands. Because we are really, generally, we're a beautiful island, beautiful people. So we just need that system to put the information out there and give us a hand and help us restore this environment. My organization was very committed, as I said, 21 years old, I was a baby. But I knew in my heart, in my soul, that I wanted to see a green and sustainable Haiti. So our organization, our main project right now, we work with grassroots organizations. They're the key, because they have to get involved with the projects so they can understand. So we have more than 23 partner grassroots organizations in Haiti, but this year, this is our 21st year of service, and we are building an environmental center and volunteer village in Acaya, Haiti, which will be available to all. Because like I said, planting the trees is one thing to reforest, but you must address the other issues, education, awareness, and give them an alternative. The reason they're cutting the trees is economics. So you have to get it for the sources. So that's all I have, because I know I was told I had 5 minutes. So I have information if you have questions, because I have a whole, they have a whole report about the state of Haiti's environment. The reports are there. But the thing is, we need action.
You might be interested to know that the Spaniards came and destroyed Puerto Rico's Fluorol Forested as well. And in 1950 and 1960, my cousin, who was Secretary of Natural Resources, wrote a book called Island in Danger of Extinction. We wiped out almost everything else that was left because of the industrialization and construction of farming and roads and everything. But we are reforesting. I always thought Haiti could be the example. That with the reconstruction, and we'll talk about that in a second, let's finish up the presentations with Marianne Klein, a perfect way to finish off. Now, you do work in the Dominican Republic and have worked there. She's the Caribbean director for the Nature Conservancy.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Nadine, for a very inspiring story. It's great to be here with so many emerging journalists, and you all know about great stories and how they transcend time and place and cultures. And a good story connects us all, and it shows the circumstances that we all share. And it's the same for our conservation work. And we've talked about three countries now in the Caribbean, but obviously the Caribbean is a huge area. It's about a third, actually, of the continental U.S. And it's comprised of 12 countries and 17 overseas territories. It's a complex region in terms of politics, different government systems, different languages ranging from Spanish to Creole to French to English, different cultures, background African American, Spanish. But there's one theme that connects all the countries in the Caribbean, and it is the environment. It's one ecosystem, it's one brain system. And there's a strong current called the Caribbean Current that meanders through this basin all year round, and it's transporting larvae from country to country. You have sharks, you have sea turtles who travel from country to country without a passport, obviously. And there are seabirds that migrate. There are birds who come from the U.S. and travel south, and they stop on all the different countries on the way down looking for warmer climate. Now, in the Nature Conservancy, we are concerned about working at the system level. We realize that the Caribbean is one system and that we need to have an impact across all these countries. And I think we're the only international conservation organization that actually works across the Eastern Caribbean. And it's very important to do local work, but it's also important to do regional work and work with governments to try to get to large-scale regional agreements as well as working at the local scale with communities. But we are all connected. And I don't know if any of you in your journalist salaries get to eat a lot of lobsters, but maybe some of you did here at this conference. But most of you probably don't know that the lobster that you eat in the restaurants here in Miami, they probably come up from Cuba. Most of them, actually, their larvae comes from Brazil, and it travels through the Caribbean, and it ends up in a place in Miami. And if we don't work in Cuba, if we don't work with Brazil, if we don't work with them to make sure that there are good environmental practices in place and regulations, we won't have lobsters in our place here. And it's the same, you look at the Caribbean current between the DR, the Haiti, Jamaica, and Cuba. We have seen models of rubber larvae, a seed that they have been transported from Western Haiti to northeastern Jamaica and then up to Cuba. So even Haiti, which we seem to look at as one of the worst environmental case, maybe in the Western Hemisphere, actually also transports a lot of other countries. Now the islands of the Greater Antilles, the three countries that we talked about, are working together. And I wanted to take a step back and look at that regional connections between the three countries. The three countries share a lot of marine species. They share a lot of the same threats to the marine environment. But their response to these challenges have been quite different. Cuba has a very well-established network of marine protected areas, marine no-take zones. They've been managed very effectively for many years. And David, you know, talks so beautifully about the good health of the coral reefs and the ecosystems in Cuba, a result of the isolation in some ways, but it's also a result of very good management, with excellent academics and practitioners in the field. The Dominican Republic also has a good system of protected areas. Actually, over 50% of the coastal and marine habitats in the Dominican Republic are decreed protected. However, it doesn't mean that these protected areas are all well managed. There's still a huge lack of resources in the Dominican Republic. There's a lack of personnel on the ground. But at least it's a huge step that we have the need to put in place. And then you go to to Haiti, and there's not one single marine protected area in place in the entire country. Which one?
Côte des Acadènes is protected, but like I said, not one force.
So in the marine environment, and there are Pico Bacalhau, for instance, one of the terrestrial, there are three national parks in protected forest. But in terms of the marine environment, there's still a long way to go. Than it is. But there are also, there is hope. And I wanted to say that actually coming Monday and Tuesday, the Conservancy, we are organizing a meeting in the Dominican Republic for 25 of government officials from Cuba, from the Dominican Republic, from Haiti, Jamaica, and Puerto Rico. And they are sitting down to discuss a proposal of a network of marine protected areas between those five countries. And also coming up with shared responses to some of the binational and trinational challenges that they all face. So there is interest, there is government interest, there's also community interest to get things moving. And I also wanted to talk a little bit just about the relationship between Dominican Republic and Haiti, because there are maybe not many places in the world where two countries are just so intertwined, and the environmental fate of one country depends on the other. And you saw the picture that Nadine showed of the border between the two countries, and it is very true. The Dominican Republic has very big forest cover, and Haiti has less than 2% forest cover. And when you travel from the Dominican Republic towards the border in Haiti, you get to the border and suddenly the forest disappears. It's quite impressive when you travel there as a person, and you see those big differences between the two countries. And I want to talk a little bit about one small project that we have been involved in for the last 5 years on the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It's a small community called Tiroli. It's got 400 families who live there. They're so removed from Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, they have no government agencies at all present in that community. So most of the government services that they get actually comes in from the Dominican Republic, where there's a road. And we've been involved in planting 30,000 trees in that community to increase the forest cover in Haiti, but also to reduce the deforestation in the Dominican Republic, because more and more, since charcoal and firewood are the two principal sources of energy in Haiti, the forests in the Dominican Republic are slowly being impacted, and you can see that borderline going further and further east. So we've been working with local partners to plant 30,000 trees, but also to introduce fruit trees as a main ingredient. Nadine talked about it so beautifully. So people don't cut down the trees because they want to, because they don't see the value. But they will particularly not cut down the fruit tree, because a mango tree can provide you with economic income, it can provide you with food. So we made a very conscious effort to include fruit trees in the mix and make family plots with fruit trees. And then the trees, obviously now, they're not big enough to be able to produce a lot of fruit. So in order for them not to cut down the trees, we also introduced solar stoves and fuel efficient stoves. And we did a pilot start with 30 families, and just last week I was back and visited. And it was market day. Most of the women on market day are in the market. Many of the men are home with their families. And when we traveled around, many of the men, when they were still over there, they came and said, "You need to talk to my wife. She makes this excellent food. She's using the solar stove. She's using fuel efficient stoves." So the men were the ones greeting us, and they were so proud of their wives, and they showed that the trees and the plots and the gardens that they made. And those are the small stories that are so inspiring and really motivates us in conservation to keep on moving. We have to work with governments. We have to work at that level of getting to regional agreements, and we need to have protected areas and free more areas. But at the same time, we have to work with the local communities to be able to make a change. So I think that these kinds of stories, actually all the stories that we've heard, they really just show you that the importance of working together. And we'll go one step ahead, and I think that we'll be able to make a change.
Yes.
And with that, we'll start the question and answer period. I don't know about you guys, but I would love for our friend community to sit up here and field questions. Is that all right with you all?
Yeah.
And in the now we're implementing the 1 minute answer. Be brief. But Nadine and Gregor, I'm curious to know from my standpoint whether you think we can turn this around and in how much time. And for Haiti to become that example to the Caribbean, because we've got four municipalities that are showing desertification that are becoming deserts. In Puerto Rico, and we're supposed to be more developed.
Well, I'm old enough. I'm kind of like the time machine that that David was talking about earlier, because when I was a kid, I was diving down here in Florida and in the Bahamas and throughout the Caribbean, and so I saw the way the reefs were when they were in good shape. In fact, I was lucky because my dad worked on sharks and he used me as shark bait in his shark experiments. That got me around the world to see reefs all over the world back in the late 60s and early 70s. But the answer to your question with respect to these situations is that La Caleta is a really good example where it's amazing, given the right conditions and given good management, that things can come back much, much faster than even a lot of biologists have led us to believe. Because basically, if you can get those herbivores back in there, the algae and fish, they clean up the algae, and it allows the corals to come back. And the water quality in places like Haiti is really good in most places. There are some areas that are affected by sedimentation, but most of the country has amazing water quality, and so the reefs will come back there. Now, we do have this disease problem that some of you might have heard about, where the two corals that David was talking about before that are so common in Cuba were apparently killed off by a disease and die off of a sea urchin that kind of helped things move along back in the 1980s. We don't have a very good handle on that disease issue. I'd like to raise another issue, which I went to Cuba, I think, in 2002, 2003, and we trained up all the marine protected area managers there in our survey methodology, and I was also amazed at the quality of the crop product in Cuba. I think that one of the other issues is that both in Cuba and in Haiti, they don't have very many motorized boats. And, you know, here in Florida, not only do we have issues with, you know, sedimentation, with nutrient pollution, lots of, you know, fertilizer and sewage coming out, but in those two countries, there's very little gasoline on the water. You know, these two-stroke engines, they pump out a lot of surface material, and there just isn't. You don't see that much in Cuba.
And in light of necessity, though, is that possible? Because we have, and you want to answer as well, Nadine?
Well, what I was going to anticipate is to follow what you were asking, how fast can it come back? The other key is getting people involved, you know, education and awareness, showing them, like you showed in like what was it? Yeah, people can see, actually show by example to see how it's going to benefit them.
But there's such a large necessity. I mean, if you're hungry, you need the fish like you saw in the video.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They have to have the alternatives when they see. So there's a possibility to get the people involved.
But you remain positive.
Yes.
You want to see.
Yes, we have a project in Southern Haiti, and I was there just a month ago, and I saw exactly what Dr. Greg was talking about. You know, that the fish is this small, but the reef itself, the structure of the reef is actually quite intact. But there's no doubt that the reef needs to rest. But I also want to say that there was one community that we visited. It's on the southwestern tip of Haiti. It's called Tiboulon, means shark. And in that community, there was one fishing association. They catch 200 marlins a month. Marlins. We saw big marlins. So what happens there is that the continental shelf is really narrow. So and they actually had fiberglass boats. That was a project by Food for the Poor. And they gave fiberglass boats and engines. Most of the boats are not functioning anymore, but in that community, they're still using them, and that allows them to catch those 200 marlins a month. But they have no way of getting the fish to market, which is quite a valuable type of fish. So they put it out to dry in the sun, and they sell it for the same price as almost any other fish. But my point is really that, you know, you do need other alternatives. If not, that the reefs in Haiti will never be able to rest.
I can speak to that. In Cuba, this magnificent protected area was the brainchild of an entrepreneur from Italy who came in and said, you know, this would be a great dive resort. And he worked with the local community and said, guys, you can get a lot more from these sharks alive than you can as dinner. And now what he's done, and then with the cooperation, of course, of the government, is the fishing communities that were depending on that area are now, that is where they are hiring all of the workers for the resorts, and I shouldn't say they're not big resorts, it's very strictly limited, but, you know, little more dive boats, the cooks, the people, there's a small floating people are the people from those local communities who are seeing direct benefit and now are so sold on this, they're making so much more, that it's the fishermen who are out patrolling to protect against other fishermen coming in to take their sharks.
Right. Yeah, I want to make a comment. You know, talking about tourism as one agent actually, yeah, that can assist conservation, it can also be a threat, obviously. It can also be sustainable. But tourism is the one, you know, main economic driver in the Caribbean, except for Haiti. And up until the early 1980s, Haiti was the most visited island in the Caribbean. I don't know if many of you knew that.
That is true. I have a lot of pictures. As a matter of fact, this week I was looking at the pictures and I called my mom and I said, look at this. I have a picture that it was.
Yes.
And it can be again.
Yes, and when you travel out of the capital and you travel down to the beaches in the south, you can just be, it's astounding. The beauty, it's magnificent. And most people have no idea also because we're always showing
the disastrous
images from Haiti. So I do think that the long-term development of Haiti is going to include tourism. And I think that there's also one way for us to partner as conservationists with tourism to manage some of these areas.
Yeah, I was wondering if that's, I mean, it sounds like you're going to create these protected areas in Haiti and that's going to be great, but you were saying enforcement is really the problem. How does that, I mean, so you're hoping that the fishermen and the communities, you know, help them?
Well, because there's two things. Of course, there's the enforcement, like we said, but if they are legally enough, if they're protected on paper, which they are now, because I have a big document, but if they're not enforced by the government, then it's not happening. But I am very hopeful because we do have a new leadership in Haiti and they're very pro-environment. So that's the reason why I'm so excited. You're saying that I'm so positive because I know the new leadership in Haiti is very pro-environment. So once we have this protected area, it's important to work with the government to make sure that they are enforced. The other issue is working with the people, just like the example that you give in Cuba. If people, we are all human, if they can see the benefit, how it's going to benefit them to change their ways and at the same time protect the environment, it's going to be benefiting them, they will be on board. And they will teach other people. So it's getting the local community involved at the same time, so it's twofold.
I don't think there's a one size fits all in terms of how protected area can and should be managed in Haiti. Obviously, you do need the government to back up a decree. You need to have the laws on your side in order to enforce them. Mm-hmm. But because the Ministry of the Environment in Haiti is very weak, it has very little resources and little personnel, there isn't the new park service in Haiti. But in this particular area, in Isla Bash, for instance, where we're trying to set up one protected area, there is some burgeoning tourism industry. There are two tour operators on the island. And the idea is really to include those as well as the local fisher communities in the management. The co-management is really what you're looking at, the idea.
You need to give the reef more value than it has as just a place to extract fish.
Do you have that number? One shark is worth, I don't know.
It's like 10,000 for a diving tourist,
yeah,
in the Maldives.
In its lifetime, yeah.
But we don't have any tourists right now in Haiti except for local internal tourists. And there's ways of fixing that. But as Marianne said, the government has zero capacity at this point to do anything. And with respect to, you know, managing something like that. So you're looking at a 10-year plan in a place like Haiti to build up the capacity of the government and the different departments you would need. So right now, the main focus needs to be on working with the locals and getting them behind the project, and that also takes some time. But like we saw in Dominican Republic with La Caleta, that was a government paper park. It was on paper, but there was zero management at all, like most of the parks in DR.
No, I absolutely agree. And World Resources Institute has done a lot of good work in quantifying and valuation of marine ecosystems. And I think applying methodologies like that in more regions, including Cuba and including Haiti, is going to give decision makers more ammunition to defend these areas. Because right now, that side of the equation doesn't get heard. Another issue that I thought I'd put on the table just because it's kind of interesting and maybe an effective tool is blue carbon. I recently was in Santo Domingo. I met with the president of the Dominican Republic and the environmental minister, and there's great interest there of being a leader in the Caribbean on this issue of blue carbon, which is essentially carbon offset projects that maximize carbon sequestration in marine ecosystems. So that means things like mangroves and seagrasses and restoration of those, where you could actually sell credits, carbon credits, for those projects. I think that the studies show there's actually more carbon to be had in the marine environment than in the terrestrial environment in this way. I've done work in the past on forestry. There are all sorts of challenges here in terms of monitoring and all that, but I think it's another possibility, especially if there's interest on the other side of the island, to do that as a united front.
Interesting. That makes sense.
I have a question for Dr. Guggenheimer. It's very interesting to point out the difference between Cuba and the surrounding countries and areas. But looking forward, there's an expectation that things will change in Cuba politically and economically. And in some ways, it'll begin to resemble its neighbors economically and politically. What does that mean for the BRAC?
It means that people that work in Cuba are very nervous, like me. And that's why we feel like our work is very urgent right now, because we have opportunities to prevent those sorts of disasters. The Cubans are very smart, and they are paying attention to all these great disasters outside of their country, and they are so dependent on tourism right now. It's still the number one part of their economy. Oil may change that, but in all likelihood, tourism is going to be front and center for a long time. So they know they have to protect that resource. But at the same time, we've seen the power of the dollar. Well, it used to be the dollar. I don't know what it is. The Canadian dollar. And we also know that Cuba is changing. And I said it at the panel earlier, the work that we do we're not stupid either or naive in thinking that things are going to stay constant in the government in Cuba. But our hope is that change will occur, and they will hold on to what's working and what's most credible and what's most successful. And we feel that the work that we're doing is based on the best available science. They are actually drafting their laws based on, for example, some of their coastal laws were drafted based on California law, some of the best in our country. So our hope is that those thoughtful policies, and even involving public participation that has been encouraged by the Environmental Defense Fund, Dan Will here, and us, where we had public meetings and all of that, the public would feel ownership of that. So it's hard work. Nothing is certain, of course. But the best thing I think we can do is just base this on the best science and include the public.
And there has been some openness in the last 3 years. Hurricane hunters are now flying over Cuba, and there is that lot. And between scientists,
I'm Bill Allen. I teach at the University of Missouri Journalism School in SEJ. I wanted to ask the young student what her belief is in terms of her generation of citizens of Haiti in protecting the environment.
Well, I was speaking English very well, but I'm trying to do my best to answer the question. Actually, especially after the earthquake, my generation, we felt really concerned about Haiti, about our environment, especially when we saw
people are talking, they say there's a lack of capacity. Yes, there's a lack of capacity, but they're not using the youth also. And we want to be involved in everything. Yes, we need to be trained. Yeah, but we also need, it's like, when you are in a country and you're working, you feel involved, you feel happier. And you see, hey, I'm working with this organization, I made this, hey, and you are also, you have all the information of your country and you can help. I'm a student, but I know a lot. Maybe I don't know how the sciences, but I see, oh, when I go to this way, I saw the rays are not good, they look really dark. This is the way I see it, but if there's a professional and he talks to me and he says, oh, okay, there's a better way to interpret it, to understand it. So I don't know if I answered the question. Would it be part of the change? Yes, and actually, I think I'm a part of the change.
Wonderful.
Any other questions? Hi, I have heard regarding Haiti that there was going to be a program a few years ago of reforestation with the Greenbelt Movement. To plant like something like a million trees, that was a progress. And then I heard that it kind of got stalled because of the, why am I blanking out on this? Maybe because it's a horrible thing, the earthquake. And also then one guy died and passed away. But does anyone have any updates on that project, or is that been shelved, or?
Well, the only person that I personally know that was working was the Lambi Fund. I know they were working with the Green Belt Movement, but I'm not aware. I know it stopped, but I'm not aware of why. I can find out.
In Puerto Rico, we're trying to become the model for the opposite, from deforestation to reforestation, and we're planting about 4 million trees a year. And banks have been really aggressive about that. So at least from our standpoint, there is a way to revert what we did, the damage we did.
But what it will take, which is the message I have that our organization is pushing, I'm working in partnership with many other nonprofits, and it has to be at this point a national movement, because the problem is so huge, different little organizations are not going to be able to have the necessary impact to really make a new and green sustainable Haiti.
So you're working with the government? Is the government?
Well, it's a new, well, we wanted them to be here, but it was, as you know, it's a new leadership. The cabinet was just from a week ago, and we do have a minister of the environment, which is wonderful. And like I said, this new leadership is pro-environment, so I'm really excited about it. It has to be a national movement.
And Lexa, do you think they're going to listen to you guys? Or because there's been a lot of oppression in the past.
It's new.
Okay, that's good. Go ahead.
I'm Dawn Stover. I'm a freelance writer, and I'm wondering, particularly in Haiti, obviously tree planting is the answer to reforestation, but that's going to take a while. What do you see as kind of the interim solutions, if any? Are we going to need to import charcoal? Is, you know, people talk a lot about stoves, but in a lot of countries, a lot of stoves have been given away, and they are later not being used or don't really work right for the cultural traditions of that area. So I'm wondering if you could talk about what you see as kind of the interim solutions to that deforestation problem.
Well, like, I just wanted to address the cultural problem, because sometimes we introduce the stove and different things, but it's going to take a long time, especially we in Haiti, when we know we've been doing things for a long, long time, it's very hard to change our mind unless we can see really the benefit to us. So that's the long term to change to something else. I don't believe in importing charcoal, but the key is to give alternatives, because they are cutting the trees for cash reason, for economic reason, so we have to, once you give them other alternatives, then they'll give time for the reforestation project to happen. So you have to give alternatives.
Yeah, I agree. But I think there's a difference when you look at energy consumption in the rural areas, or also versus the capital of Port-au-Prince. And there's a good analogy to the Dominican Republic. Dominican Republic also used to be very dependent on charcoal and fuel wood. And the government has started a huge subsidy program for propane and gas. And it really was a big factor in reducing the deforestation of the country. And when you go to Port-au-Prince, when you go to the capital, then you still see that charcoal is being used, even in some of the businesses, they're still using firewood. I do think that you have to look at other sources of energy, and I think, you know, you have to go to some of them.
And I can't say enough education and awareness, because as growing up, now I am aware, but even the richer people, sometimes they have the electric or kitchen inside their home, but they always have the charcoal kitchen outside. So people have to be aware of how it's affecting the environment. So information, awareness.
I also want to answer your question related to, you know, why hasn't, you know, things worked for it in the past in Haiti? And we all know that there's been a lot of development progress in Haiti, a lot of conservation projects. And there was a study recently done by the United Nations Environmental Agency, UNEP, and they looked at why have so many of the projects failed, and they came up with two answers. One is that most of them are short term. You know, if you don't look beyond 5, 10, or more years, you won't be successful. And the other one was that we all work in our own sector. So here is the environmental movement, we're doing environmental projects, then you have the clean energy movement, then you have education and health, and we're not working together. And the one project that we are now involved in Southern Haiti is leaded by UNEP. And the reason that we got really excited about it is that they decided to work with all sectors simultaneously. So there's Catholic Relief Services, there's the Earth Institute in Colombia, there's environmental organizations, and the Norwegian government is providing a lot of assistance and looking also at setting up some small hydro electrical plants in some of the rivers. They're looking at building an international airport in the Kai to bring in tourism. So suddenly the environment is just not one, you know, small piece or something done in isolation, but it's really becoming integrated across all these sectors. And I think that's the new thinking in terms of the development movement as well.
Okay, we're out of time. Any more quick questions, or is there anything you wanted to say?
Can I just add one thing? There's a huge difference on the marine side between Cuba and Dominican Republic on the one hand and Haiti, and that is that both Cuba and the Dominican Republic set up a network of marine protected areas about 20 years ago. They've got major universities that teach marine biology. They have marine biologists coming out their ears. There's, you know, wonderful, super, you know, 30 years, 40 years experience marine biologists in both countries. In Haiti, they have none of that, and so we're on a much bigger learning curve.
That are you working towards that?
Absolutely.
Any more questions?
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.